I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. The company was founded by Jennifer's father, but the bottles weren't widely accepted by customers until recently. The product, called the Adiri Natural Nurser, is available nationwide in stores including The Right Start, Babies R Us, and Whole Foods. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does the Adiri bottle differ from other baby bottles on the market right now?
Well, it has a more soft texture, breast-like feel than other bottles on the market. The design of it is very unique in that it opens from the bottom. It's very simple to use. You just unscrew it from the bottom and fill it from the bottom. It's also polycarbonate free, and there's only a few bottles on the market at the moment besides glass bottles that are polycarbonate free. And that's become quite a big issue as there's some questionable health issues with polycarbonate plastic. There has been some science that says that the polycarbonates and bisphenol A, which is in the polycarbonate plastic, can interfere with endocrine function, which is necessary in the development of the nervous system.
One of the other differentiators is the fact that the nipple is indeed shaped like a breast.
It's shaped like a breast. The previous product that was my dad's invention was called the Breast Bottle Nurser. It was actually a half dome that was very much like a woman's breast. And it was almost self-consciously like a breast that people were embarrassed to use it. Our bottle is a little less self-consciously like a breast. It still has a dome like a breast and a standard baby bottle nipple. And it also is made of this very, very soft plastic. So it actually feels, when it's filled with warm milk, it does feel like a breast.
Now, you talk about the earlier product really looking even more like a breast, which made people uncomfortable. Were men more uncomfortable by the shape than women?
It was both. It was so different than anything on the market, so different from a conventional baby bottle, that there was that high acceptance curve to begin with. Just, do I want to use something that's so wildly different than everything else I see on the shelves? Then, of course, there was, with both women and men, this feeling of not really wanting to hold which would look like a breast.
Right. Now, you're not the founder of the company. You're the CEO. Your father founded the company. Where does the name of the company, Adiri, come from?
My father had a lot of different ways of looking at the world. And one of the things that he wanted to do was to bring together different symbology in his life. The name Adiri pulls together different parts of women's names that he had loved in his life. The other thing was he was a savvy businessman, and he wanted to be at the top of search engines. And he knew that to be at the top of the search engines at the time, you needed to have an A word, sort of like AAA locksmith.
What did your father do in his life?
Well, he started out his career as in hotel and restaurant development.
And then how did he transition to become an inventor?
Well, he was always mechanically oriented. He was a mechanic in high school, an auto mechanic. He always created things. There's lots of stories that his friends will tell from high school about how he would, you know, make a motorized vehicle when everybody else was just learning to fix their bike. And then he also was an artist throughout his life. He did pottery. He had a stained glass business even when he was an executive. He made stained glass weather vanes in the shape of a monarch butterfly, and he sold them through the Horchow catalog and major catalogs. And he eventually left the executive world just to be an artist and an inventor.
What are some of the other inventions that he created other than the bottle?
He had a number of inventions that had to do with environmentally progressive technologies, like wind generators and new engines. So he was very interested in furthering environmental causes. He also invented a whimsical musical fountain. This fountain was such that it had various tubes, and when the water hit the tubes, they would play different notes.
Despite all these different inventions, really his favorite, or his baby, was this bottle.
Well, I think that he felt that the bottle was the most commercially viable.
What were you doing at the time while your father was trying to get this bottle company off the ground?
Well, I was living a very conventional life. I went to law school. I became a lawyer, and I had a very 9-to-5 existence, stocking away money in my savings accounts. And although he tried on a number of occasions to interest me in working with him on the business, I was not geared that way. It was not something I wanted to do.
You were a lawyer at Yahoo for a few years. And what was the catalyst for your saying, okay, you know what, I do want to make this transition?
Well, in the early spring of 2005, my father died. And it was actually a very difficult time for me. I had a 2-month-old. And so I was in that difficult period where you're thinking about going back to work. And you know that it's going to be a huge transition from your maternity leave to full-time work. And so I was gearing up for that. I had a 2-year-old as well. And then my father dies suddenly, and it was actually a suicide. So it was a very traumatic death for me. And I had his business that I inherited. I was the executrix of his estate. And I was forced to learn this business, and really through that whole process and realizing I could get through all of that, I'm like, you know, I probably can run this business.
Now, obviously people have a lot of reasons for killing themselves. What part of his reasoning do you think was connected with this business?
In some respects, he was very pessimistic. He thought we were going to have a nuclear war way back when. And he was also extremely optimistic. And when he invented this product in the 90s, he thought he was going to be a multimillionaire. And he put his heart, his soul, all his money into the company. And all he did was lose money. And he, you know, left this world with having made no money off of the company. It actually owes him money at this point, the estate money. And yeah, so.
And to what extent did your wanting to pick this up, pick the pieces up, what part of that desire came from a sense of responsibility versus a sense of, you know what, I think this is a viable company and I think I could really create something valuable here?
Well, there was a huge sense of responsibility. I remember looking through his emails. I had saved all of his emails. Mm-hmm. And I was also looking through emails that he had written to a guy he was working with at the time. And one of the things he said to this guy was, you know, my daughter has a friend who's interested in buying the business. This was a couple years before he died. I really want you to get them everything they need because my dream is to have my daughter take over the business. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I felt an incredible sadness, of course, that it had never happened in his lifetime, but also a major responsibility. But quite honestly, I couldn't sell the business. I tried. So I was stuck with it. And I, you know, that combined with the fact that I started talking with this fantastic industrial designer, Whipsaw, and they were so excited about the project. And really, I started to see the potential here. And I was like, you know what? This is something that might take off. And I want to be a part of it.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. So you decide, okay, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to leave my stable job at Yahoo and get this off the ground. How did that happen logistically? Did you work on this part-time while you were still at Yahoo, or what was that early day situation like?
Well, it was a crazy time. I had an amazing boss. So they let me do this crazy life of trying to sell the business while I was working as a lawyer for Yahoo. I worked a 4-day schedule and I would do things like fly to trade shows. And I shared a booth with this other company. And they kept saying, why aren't you selling the product? Get out there. Just get out there and sell. They were standing in the aisles with their product. And so I said, you know, I'm just not a salesperson, and plus this is a ridiculous looking product. It looks like a breast. And so they took it and they went out to the aisles and they're trying to sell it. And then they came back and said, you know, don't quit your day job. And there was that. And then there was the conference calls in my office trying to, you know, keep the doors closed so nobody would know I was actually talking to a baby products company and not, you know, an internet company. It was difficult. But then eventually, after a year of that, I just was like, you know, I'm ready.
Now, in the meantime, you have two small children at home and a husband. How did they feel about it, or at least your husband feel about your leaving this job that was providing some stable income and going to a entrepreneurial endeavor where you're making zero right now?
Well, at the risk of sounding ingenuine, my husband is really, he's so supportive. And when I told him, you know, I'm about to go into a job where I will have no money for, you know, no salary coming in, and it could totally tank, and I might be even more stressed out than I am now. And he said, go for it. He also had a lot of faith in the design, in the redesign.
No. So what did you do from there? You said you spoke to a design firm. What did they do to change the product?
Well, we talked with this design firm, Whipsaw, and they are mostly do electronics, consumer electronics. And so they were very excited about taking on something completely different. First of all, they're very much into imitating nature to the extent possible, which my dad was also into. He said, if nature is the best inventor, and you would do well to imitate nature. Then me and my business partners went and we talked to hundreds of mothers and said, what do you want to see in this product? And that was the most important thing. And we would take that back to Whipsaw. They showed us 10, 20 designs. Together, Whipsaw and the team of us who were mothers and had talked to mothers came up with this design that's won multiple awards and is, you know, being carried by major chains now.
It seems like you fell into an entrepreneurial role accidentally to some extent, and you became the CEO after you had been a lawyer for many years. Talk to me a little bit about that dynamic.
Well, as a lawyer, I was always trying to present the side of caution, like, okay, this is what could happen if we don't put this clause into the agreement. And the business person would always say, in a million years, that might happen. And I would always say, yes, but my job is to cover that in a million years. And so we'd have that back and forth. When I suddenly switched over, I found myself doing deals on a handshake. I mean, I have a lot of partners that I work with now, major partners, like our manufacturer, who we don't have a written agreement with. So when you're actually out in the real world and I am that business person on the other side of the table from me when I was at Yahoo saying, this is ridiculous. Unfortunately, I don't have an obligation to a large corporation to, you know, I do have an obligation to the shareholders, but I do feel like I'm acting in their best interest.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. We'll hear more from Jennifer coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. The company was founded by Jennifer's father, but the bottles weren't widely accepted by customers until recently. The product, called the Adiri Natural Nurser, is available nationwide in stores including The Right Start, Babies R Us, and Whole Foods. How did people receive you now that you were the CEO and an accidental entrepreneur, not having had a past in getting companies off the ground?
Well, at first, I was very self-deprecating, and that in some respects served me well because a lot of people were willing to go the extra effort to help me. My father had recently killed himself. I had inherited this business, and people were amazingly generous with their time and resources. I got discounted services. And I was genuinely, every self-deprecating thing I said was honest. I genuinely had no idea what I was doing. However, over time, that didn't serve me well. And I started to realize that that I was doing myself a disservice by presenting myself to the world as a complete novice. And so when we did get the Babies R Us deal, I was telling a woman that I'd actually asked to be my business partner early on, but she felt like it wasn't the right move for her at the time, given their financial situation and other reasons. And she said, wow, Babies R Us, soon you'll need a real CEO. And at the time, I remember thinking, maybe she's right. And then I was like, you know what? What is a real CEO? I am doing fine, and I have a vision, and I started to realize that I really needed to own that and not talk myself down. This, another example of that is when we went to get our round of funding valuation, and we went to the valuator and we gave him sales forecasts that we had very carefully come up with throughout the world, and we had looked at populations and other bottle sales, and we had really spent a lot of time on our forecast. And he said, you know, these are wildly optimistic. I can't do a valuation based on these because I really don't think they're right. And we said, well, we do think they're right. And he said, well, you know, why don't you just go with half? He's like, even if you did half of these sales, it would be pretty good for three moms in a kitchen. And yeah. And it was another one of those, huh, is he really saying that from a sexist point of view, or have I just been talking us up as three moms in the kitchen? You know, which is it? Mm-hmm. Have I been presenting that to the world? And at some point, you have to stop slamming yourself, and you just have to say, you know, I have a vision. I have a great product. After 2 years of really just amazing challenges and setbacks and just plowing on, eventually you just have to say, I must be doing something right.
Now, you mentioned that you don't have a natural sales personality, and you're not naturally an entrepreneur. How did you go about finding partners for this? You work with two other women. How did you find them?
Well, I asked around. I talked to friends of mine and told them that I was about to embark on running this company, and did they know anybody that was willing to work for nothing, spend time away from their kids, possibly pay money for childcare, and was willing to work on this product, which at the time a lot of people were laughing about, the breast bottle, and making that into something completely new. And so I really just interviewed one person, and we had a connection, and she seemed very solid, and she came highly recommended, and Beth Shavodian. She and I embarked on this thing together, and it was we would laugh how much like a junior achievement in high school it was like. We would just sit there in our office and laugh. She'd be sitting there on a typewriter that we looked all over town to find, doing the stock certificates. And then we found our other business partner, Sarah Eisner. She was a photographer, and after the photo shoot, she came up to us and said, you know, I'd really love to work with you guys. Do you have a job opening? And we explained to her, the only job openings we have are unpaid. You'll have to pay for childcare, et cetera, et cetera. And so she decided that wasn't for her immediately. And she consulted with us for 2 months. And then we asked her again, mm-hmm. How about coming aboard for no money? And she said yes, because it was looking promising.
So it's you and your partner, and you're sitting in this office now in the San Francisco area where you guys are based. Walk me through a day in the life.
Well, we share, at the time when we started, we shared an office, a garage. It was actually a garage with two other internet startups. And they were valid startups, Silicon Valley startups with venture capital. One's actually been bought by a Johnson & Johnson company, Baby Center, since then. Yeah. And they would often bring in these venture capitalists and, you know, big names in the Silicon Valley. And even though they always take pains to introduce us, there was always sort of that sense of, hey, make a bottle, you know, don't mind them. And we had the bottles out on our desk, and it was sort of like the office joke. But yeah, we would sit at our little grouping of desks that were pushed together and just laugh about how we were going about doing simple things like our letterhead, for example. We actually did our letterhead. We had an 800 number that my father actually had originally purchased and put on all of the literature. And we got 3,000 sheets of letterhead. And then we went to a trade show with our price list on this letterhead. And one of the potential customers came up to us and said, you know, I tried calling your 800 line because I wanted to place an order. And I'll just place an order in person because, you know, you might want to check your 800 line. It's not very nice. And we said, really? What is it? And she said, well, I might have called the wrong number, but it's a porn line. Oh. And so we were horrified, and we got the cell phone out. We called the number, and sure enough, and this is on 3,000 sheets of letterhead, our price list that was at this major industry show, it was a porn line because we actually have an 888 number, and I had put 1-800. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing that is very embarrassing, especially when you're at a trade show with big companies like Playtex and One of their salespeople came over and said, "You're the company with the porn line." And that's how we, you know, here we have a bottle that looks like a breast and we've got a porn line on our letterhead. And it was just very hard to be taken seriously at the get-go.
Well, I guess it taught you to pay attention to details.
Yes, we've gotten better at that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. So you built your team, you changed the design of the bottle. Were there any interesting or crucial inflection points for you? Was there a certain set of customers that became really enthusiastic about the product that helped to get you guys to the next level?
Well, I knew we really had something when we started to send out pictures of the prototype, and we took it to a few trade shows, including American Academy of Pediatrics and another big trade fair for our industry. And people would come up and say, "Bravo." You know, it had the wow factor. And the wow factor is something I'd always aspired to with this bottle.
Was there a retailer that accepted the product that helped to launch sales?
Well, I was at a trade show. And it was the third day of the trade show. And things were really winding down. It was very quiet on the floor. And I was giving my sales pitch to a couple women at the booth, and I just asked them where they were from, and I looked on the badge, and it was the Babies R Us buyer. Really, that was the moment when they said, "We came to you because we'd heard about you." I'm like, maybe we have something here.
And juxtaposed with that feeling, what's an example of a dark time that you felt like, maybe I shouldn't be pursuing this, or, wow, this is kind of tough, just as an example of...
That is funny, because... I think the ratio of dark days to good days is probably pretty high. We've had a lot of setbacks and glitches. Originally, we wanted to make the bottle two pieces. It was very important to us to have it be extremely simple. A lot of bottles on the market have lots of parts that are easy to lose. And if you try to assemble it in the middle of the night, it can be very frustrating. And at some point, we realized there's no way to do this as a two-piece bottle. The valve part of the bottle just, it wasn't working out in terms of the design to have it be one piece.
By the way, when you say valve, this is on the bottom of the bottle, and it neutralizes the pressure so that the child doesn't ingest air when he or she is imbibing.
That's right. And we really wanted to have a valve that did reduce colic and that did a good job equalizing pressure. Also, because the material of the nipple is very soft, you need something to reinflate it as the child is drinking so that it doesn't collapse. So we decided after a lot of going back and forth that we were not going to be able to do a one-piece cap and valve. And that was a dark moment for us because we had been selling it as a two-piece bottle. We had already told everybody our release date, and we were way past it, and it was just one of those things where we're never going to figure this out, and that was the general feeling at the time.
But you ultimately did figure out
this. We did. Mm-hmm. Everything can be figured out, and that's one thing I've learned, and it's been the most valuable lesson, is that you may not win every challenge, but you can always find some sort of solution. It may not be the one that you wanted. It may not be a 100% win, but there's always a way to jump any hurdle.
And how often are you interfacing with mothers? I heard that you make home deliveries or that you go to mothers' homes. What is that?
Yeah, we talk to moms 3-4 times a day. Just a couple weeks ago, I had one mother call me, and she had a problem with one of our bottles. Something was wrong with the flow of the bottle, and she was desperate. She had a baby that would not take any other bottle, and it turned out that she didn't live far from me. And so that was a time that we had a really bad storm in California, and there most of the area was blacked out. Power was out all over the place. And I said, "Well, you know, I could bring you the bottle. I know that you may not want me to because privacy concerns and the storm and, you know, all that." And she said, no, come down. Come to my house." Mm-hmm. So I came to her house. She came to the door with a flashlight and a baby in her arms. And I had my daughter in the driveway in the car. And, you know, I handed her the goods. And it was sort of like a, you know, an underworld transaction. And then I got back in the car and explained to my daughter what we had just done. But yeah, that happens a lot. I definitely feel like I know a lot of new moms in the world.
Maybe that's a blessing, not having too much capital, because you then have to do everything yourself and be resourceful and have this customer interaction that you might not have if you had a customer service department.
Yes, it's a blessing and a curse. There, at some point, you realize that being a generalist is not serving you well, and that you really do need to get some expertise in certain areas. Mm-hmm. We're starting to reach that point where we really do need a dedicated customer service department. We really do need a dedicated accountant. We are starting to need these people on staff. And so we're having to make that difficult decision. How much capital do we need to bring in to really grow this business?
Right. Now, where is the capital coming from at this point?
Right now, all of the shareholders are family members and friends. And we have a few outside folks, but no large investors.
How quickly are your sales growing at this point?
They would be growing a lot faster if we had the inventory. We have right now 10,000 back orders. We are getting reorders from big stores like Whole Foods and Right Start on a regular basis, but it's very hard for us right now to fill those orders given inventory issues and manufacturing issues.
What are some of those issues?
We had a big shipment come in few weeks ago that was about 15,000 bottles, and we were really counting on that shipment to fill a bunch of orders. And we shipped out some of them and started to get calls that the flows were too fast. The milk was pouring out into the baby's mouth. And whenever we get a call like that, we immediately replace the bottle. And it was starting to get to the point where, you know, something's wrong with a shipment. So we started to QA each one here in the U.S. to see what was going on. And there was...
You started to what?
A quality test. So we basically, with 15,000 bottles, filled each one up with water and held it up to see how it flowed and then put it out to dry. Very, very, very frustrating. You know, we realized that this a lot of the shipment was problematic, and we are now moving to a different way of drilling the hole so that it's more consistent. Mm. But that was a major setback.
How resolute are you about just seeing this through?
There are days when I joke with my husband, you know, that whoever will offer me $5,000 for the company, it's sold. But, you know, realistically, I mean, I never got to go on the radio at Yahoo. I never got to go. Last week we were giving bottles out to Denise Richards, Tori Spelling, big celebrities at a celebrity baby gift giveaway. You know, that's the kind of thing I never got to do before. It is mostly a huge adventure, and of course I'm going to keep going with it. It's been amazing to me, the press engine. You get one press mention, somebody else picks it up, and then it kind of has a life of its own. Mm-hmm. We were recently in the New York Times, and that generated all sorts of interesting opportunities from a media standpoint.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri, a company that produces baby bottles that most closely simulate breastfeeding. The company was founded by Jennifer's father, but the bottles weren't widely accepted by customers until recently. The product, called the Adiri Natural Nurser, is available nationwide in stores including The Right Start, Babies R Us, and Whole Foods. Now, you are a mom of two, as you mentioned before. Did you ever use the bottle, or did you ever feel like you needed to use the bottle for your kids?
My kids, I breastfed my kids, and when I went back to work, I was lucky. They took a bottle very easily. I just was a stressed out working mother, and the product had to be easy. It had to be very straightforward. So I found my father's product, the breast bottle, just too time consuming. There was too high of a learning curve. Sometimes it wouldn't necessarily screw together right. Sometimes it leaked. And so I did use it when my father was in town. I did use it when he called me on the phone and told me I needed to use it. And I did use it just on occasion when I had the patience. But for the most part, I used other bottles.
Because the bottle that your dad had created, the first prototype, was very clunky and difficult to use to some extent.
Very engineering. It was not that attractive. It had the threads of the screw top where you had to line them up just right.
Did you try to give him feedback?
Yes. My father had two strikes against him in terms of success. And one was that he didn't have the capital to really do a redesign, even if he wanted to. The second one is that he was very sure he knew what his customers, what was best for his customer, even if they didn't know, despite mm-hmm. him not even having been around at all when we were kids, because he was on the road a lot. I gave him feedback from mother's groups. I would take his product around and show people and try to get them interested. And even though I wasn't using it myself, but I did take the product around as a dutiful daughter, and I would get feedback. And for example, at one mother's group, they said, it would be really neat if it came in different colors, you know, if it just didn't look so breast-like and it came in different colors. So I told my dad that, and he went ballistic. He said, are you kidding? This is a serious medical product. And at the time, it was wildly carried by hospital lactation centers. It definitely served an important medical use. And I could see his point, but these mothers wanted something that looked good. And that wasn't something he was willing to hear.
How do you think your father would feel now if he could see what you've established, even in the changes that you've made, but the success that you're having?
Well, he'd be extremely happy and pleased. He would also have a few things to tell me about how to change the product or, you know, things that I wasn't doing quite right. He always had his 2 cents about how to run things.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Jennifer Morrill, CEO of Adiri. Coming up, we'll meet Simon Pierce, the glass blower and founder of the glass company Simon Pierce. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Simon Pierce, a glassblower, potter, and founder of Simon Pierce, a company that sells high-quality glass, furniture, and pottery for the home. Simon is a hands-on craftsman who started selling his glass in rural Ireland in the 1960s. Even today, he generates his own electricity, builds his own furnaces, and makes all of his glass by hand. Simon Pierce has an international presence, including 12 retail stores in San Francisco and on the East Coast of the United States. Simon, can you please describe your business and tell me how your interest in glass originated?
Well, the emphasis on things to use on the table. And it all started, well, it started with pottery because my father was a potter and he made functional pottery. I did pottery for a number of years and then I switched to glass because nobody was making glass of the kind that I really liked, which had the same character as the pottery, which had a handmade feeling, like the early English rummers and the French rummers of 150 years ago. I used to buy them in junk shops for 50 cents in those days. They've now become sort of collector's pieces, and they're more expensive, but they had a very simple, a beautiful simplicity about them, a real feeling of handmade, which I really liked. And so that's how I got into the glass business.
Where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in County Cork in the southeast of Ireland. My father moved there when I was 4 years old. And contrary to what everyone believes, I'm not Irish. I actually have no Irish blood. My mother was Welsh and my father was English, and I was born in London. But we moved there when I was four, and Ireland's the country that feels like my home. My father was actually a very interesting man because his father started a printing works in London, but he really didn't want to live in London. And he discovered this little village. The story goes he got the ferry to Cork and he had his bicycle with him and he rode it down 20 miles to this village called Shanagarry and stayed with some friends he'd been given the name of. And he was meant to stay for afternoon tea and he stayed for the rest of his life.
He seems to have had an adventurous spirit, just getting off the ferry and taking his bike and deciding he wanted to live there. Do you feel like you have some of that adventurous spirit in you?
Yeah, I probably have too much of it in me. It's interesting now you say that, where it comes from, but we definitely had that adventurous spirit. And I was very dyslexic, which nobody knew at that time in Ireland, and I really was never meant to be at school. It just didn't work. You know, school and I just didn't agree, and I'd keep running away, and they'd keep sending me back. And It's actually an interesting story. I kept saying to my parents, I want to leave school. And they said, well, you can't leave school. You know, you have to go to school. And I kept doing, every summer I'd say, I want to leave school. And finally they said, okay. And I was 15. And, you know, I was halfway through high school. And I thought, wow, that was easy. You know, that's amazing. I hadn't really expected them to say yes, but they did. And I spent a year at home working in the pottery. And then I went off to New Zealand to learn to make pottery when I was 16. When I came home a few years later, when I was 21, I was sitting opposite my father at a dinner party, and I overheard him say to the person beside him, when Simon was expelled from school, and I had never known till that moment that I actually had been expelled. They hadn't just let me leave. They'd had to let me leave, but they'd never told me.
What a sign of your parents trying to instill a sense of confidence in their dyslexic son. They were followers of this educator named A.S. Neal, who advocated a form of education allowing your children to do anything they wanted. Can you explain that a little more?
He basically believed in the child and believed that the children who were having problems or in trouble just weren't really being helped find their path. And so in his school, there was basically, you didn't have to go to school. You literally never had to go to a class at Summerhill. And he found that the kids, he really wanted to go to school. But if you forced them and if you made them, it didn't work. And they pretty much ran the school. They made all the rules. They decided, you know, how people should be punished or if they should and when. And it was a very extraordinary place.
And how did that manifest itself as a child? Are there any anecdotes that you can recall?
Yeah, my parents basically brought us up like that. We had an extraordinary level of freedom, always. They believed in letting the child find the limits. In other words, they never said, don't touch, don't do that, don't go there. There was virtually no don'ts. One day I wanted to go up to the chimney, and I was, I think, 8 years old. And there was quite a steep slate roof. My mother couldn't bear to watch me do this, but she couldn't stop me either. She didn't want to stop me. So she got in the car and left while I climbed out the skylight and climbed up onto the top of the roof and looked out, you know, over the bay or whatever I wanted to do and came down. But that was the degree to which they believed that we should find our own limits and barriers. To me, that seemed absolutely normal. And today, here in this country, you'd probably be arrested, you know,
child negligence.
Child negligence or something.
Have you translated that philosophy onto your own family?
I would say we had very much the same parenting skill. We did it the same way. I think we toned it down a bit, so our life as parents was not quite as crazy as my parents.
Or as miserable.
I mean, they had some tough times with us because it's not an easy philosophy to execute.
What I also found interesting about your parents was not only instilling the sense of self-confidence and adventure, but they also placed an emphasis on the products that you used in their in your home. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was really what their sort of life centered around was, I think, beautiful objects and beautiful things. And music. My father he loved classical music and books because he had an antiquarian bookstore at one point. But they had this sort of philosophy that everything you used should be thought about. In other words, you didn't just buy something without taking some trouble to look at it and make sure that it was something you really wanted and really liked and that was really beautiful. And that didn't mean the things were expensive. I mean, I'm talking about things like egg cups, every little detail.
In a way, that whole emphasis portended or foreshadowed your interest in pottery and glass. Was it more through osmosis, or did you sort of have an epiphany moment where you said, I want to be a potter and a glass blower, and I want to make a business of this?
No, it was much more through osmosis. I always knew I'd do something with my hands. That I don't know why, but from very early age, I knew that I would work with my hands. And I think at that age, I wanted to try something different and different than what my father had done. That was at that same time I started collecting that early glass that I liked so much. So that's how the two kind of came along.
My guest is Simon Pierce, a glassblower, potter, and founder of Simon Pierce, a company that sells high-quality glass, furniture, and pottery for the home. How do you then turn this interest in glass into a business?
It was very hard to get into the business. I wrote to 15 companies in Europe, and most of them never applied, and the ones that did said no. Glass was just beginning in Europe in those days, studio glass. There was only one school in England called the Royal College of Art that had a glass department. And it turned out that a friend of ours was on the board of the Royal College, and she introduced me to the professor who ran it. And my belief had been if I was went to a college, you know, I'd never learn the skill. But it was the only option I had. And the professor at the time said he'd take me on for a year. And I was right. If I'd been there for 50 years, I never would have learned to blow glass. But it acted as a great stepping stone, you know, and I've always been very grateful to him for giving me that opportunity to at least get in somewhere. So then I went to the Rietveld Academy in Amsterdam. And then one of the professors there said, well, you should go down to Leerdam, which is a famous glass factory. And that's where I discovered the secret of getting into glass factories. You just go and you arrive and you talk to the foreman, not the top people who run it. That was where I got my first reel in. And I worked in that factory for 3 months with their master glassmaker as his assistant, just his gopher. And then I went down to Venice and got into a glass factory there called Vanini, which is one of the famous Italian factories, and worked there for 3 months. And my job there was at about 6 in the morning when they started. I would go out to the local store and buy liters of white wine and liters of Coca-Cola and mix them 50-50. That's what they would drink from 6 o'clock in the morning until they staggered out of there at about 2 in the afternoon.
What is one called, that concoction?
Well, it doesn't have a name that I know of, but it was great for the thirst, and it kept everyone happy. And they were the most skillful glassmakers I've ever seen anywhere. They were making the most incredibly elaborate pieces, unbelievable.
So how old were you during all this time? Were you in your teens?
I was about 19 when I was in doing that.
So then at what point do you say, okay, I'm ready, I have enough experience and expertise, I'm going to go back home to Ireland and open up my own shop?
Well, it had been 2 years since the time I started at the Royal College and I finished in Scandinavia. So it was 2 years. I got my inheritance from my father, which was $10,000. The Irish government gave me some help, and they had a small business loan, which I got from them. And so I put it all together and built this factory. West Factory was a small workshop, really. I was interested in making functional glass, simple, beautiful, functional glass for everyday use. I wasn't interested in making art glass, one-of-a-kind pieces. But an interesting antidote, on my way back from Europe, I'd made a whole lot of samples of the sort of glass I wanted to make. And they were pretty basic and crude and so on, but I was very proud of them and I thought they were beautiful. And I went to London and I went to see the buyer at the General Trading Company and Liberty's, and I think it was Harrods was the other one, you know, and I proudly showed them my ware and said, you know, and they said, oh no, our customers would never be interested in something as basic or as crude as that, you know, that we'd never have a market for that. So that kind of deflated me a little bit. But I went back to Ireland and set up my workshop because I still believed, and I had enough friends who I knew were giving me honest feedback. The interesting thing about that is within 5 years, once I got going and we got a lot of publicity because I think that it was so unusual what we were doing in the very early days. All three stores came back looking for the product and never having realized that I had visited them or they had been turned me down. You know, there was that sort of disconnect. Once you've been written about and there's something, people think there's something special about what you're doing, then people change. It's amazing how that happened. But so I was trying to do, as everybody does when they start as their first small business, everything. And I blew glass every day, but I'd be up all night with the furnaces trying to get the glass to melt. And I was also trying to run the business. I mean, trying to get the orders and trying to sell the product. And
how were you at the business? Because you had focused so much on the craft side of things. Did you like the business component, or did your father instill some sort of business acumen in you?
One of the things that I felt was really special about him was that he really enjoyed both parts of the business. He really enjoyed making pottery and all aspects of the making, and he also really enjoyed the business. He really enjoyed keeping his books, even though there was kind of one little ledger, but he really enjoyed that. And he really enjoyed dealing with the customers, and he really enjoyed selling the product. He had incredibly good business principles, like he was never late with an order. If you ordered Sonic and he said you'll have it in 3 weeks, you had it in 3 weeks. And so I observed those growing up, and it was a great, great advantage, because I think many craftspeople would have a much easier life if they enjoyed the business side. But there's kind of this thing that we craftspeople can pick up, which is that the business is kind of a dirty word, you know. If you're into making things, beautiful things, then the business and making things don't really go together. But in fact, once you make something and sell it, you're in business. Whether you like it or not, you're in business.
Luckily, you did enjoy both sides, the craft and the business. How does your business then end up on the other side of the Atlantic in New England?
I was getting frustrated running the business in Ireland. There was a lot of things in those days that made it very difficult. And a lot of the basic services didn't work very well, like the phone and the post office and the taxes. So I just was getting very frustrated. It was after 10 years and the business was finally beginning to work financially. It took about 8 years for it to break even, and I decided to move to America.
And why did America appeal to you as a place to open up your business?
Because all my dealings with Americans, and we exported quite a bit of glass, and I say to small accounts, small amounts, but quite a few around the country, and all my dealings with Americans had been incredibly straightforward, and they did business, it seemed, the way I liked doing business, which was, you know, you just do what you say you're going to do and you get on with it. And I love New England, I love Vermont, and I love the feeling of the country up there. And
were there things that were more difficult than you had expected initially?
Yes, there were. The only thing that was really threw me for a loop was the cost of doing business. And that was a real struggle. The things we didn't really have to do in Ireland, or didn't cost much if you did do them, like use lawyers and have insurance. All those sort of basic things that people use a lot of in this country and you have to use in business here, and health insurance and all, we didn't have those.
And where did you set up shop in Vermont when you came?
We found this extraordinary woolen mill. It's an old brick woolen mill on a river in Vermont in a village called Queechy. And it's absolutely a spectacular sight. And the moment I saw it, I fell in love with it. I had a strong sense that Queechy would work, looking at the map and where it is in relationship to Boston and the major highways and all the tourists that come up for the summers and fall and so on. And it was just an extraordinarily beautiful sight.
It is. It is. I've been. And what are your total sales?
Total sales are about $30 million.
And when you first came to the United States, which was when? In
1971.
What were your sales once you got the mill off the ground?
I can't remember exactly, but I think we probably did about 100,000. You know, I can remember it took us about 5 years to break $1 million. And I thought that was, you know, the moon. I never in my wildest dreams thought we would do $1 million in sales. Well, no, not quite. It doesn't work like that. I always remember when the Irish Times wrote an article about me after we'd set up here, and they talked about the Irish millionaire. And I said, well, only in Ireland would they call somebody a millionaire who owes $1 million. It was a bit of everything. And it was that the retail store in Queechy was really the bedrock of the whole business. I wanted to make it a destination, almost an educational destination, where people could really come and see the product being made and use it, eat off it in the restaurant, drink out of it. So we had a glass making, we had the pottery, and we had the restaurant, and we had the retail store, where people could not only see it, but touch it. I always have a hard time with parents who tell their children not to touch the glass, because I love the children to touch the glass. And the children never break the glass. It's the parents who break all the glass. Mm-hmm. You know, they knock it off with their handbags or so on. But so
you should have a sign saying, children, please touch.
Yeah, we should have a sign saying that. Because to me, and that goes back to my mother and the education where, you know, the message you send to the child when you tell them not to touch, I think, is a really, really negative message. Because you're really telling the child it's not smart enough to pick this glass up without breaking it. And I think that it's a very, very strong message if from the time the child is born until it's an adult, it's been told, no, you can't do this, you can't do that, because you're not smart enough to pick it up without breaking it, which is so. Anyway, I shouldn't go off on my educational things.
Well, no, for those parents listening, I think they might want a lesson or two from Simon Pierce. Incidentally, you have a purple, it looks like a purple flower as your logo. What is that, that purple flower?
What that is, it's called a puntle mark. And when you make the glass and blow it, there's two ways to finish it. The way they used to finish it 100 years ago, which is you put a attach it to another rod on the bottom, and you break the glass off the blowing iron, so it's now supported by this rod, which is called a puntle iron. It's a French word. And you heat up the rim in a little furnace called a glory hole, and you hand finish the rim. And that's how we finish most of our glass. And it also leaves this mark, which is our trademark, which is the puntle mark.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
You're so welcome. It was a real pleasure to be with you.
My guest has been Simon Pierce, the founder of Simon Pierce, a company that makes handmade pottery and glass for the home. If you'd like to listen to the show online, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com. If you have questions or comments about the show or about an endeavor you're trying to get off the ground, please email us at talk@fromscratchradio.com. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.